This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off. I'm Bob Garfield. If last week was mayhem...
At least 10 packages have been sent to people who are frequently singled out by criticism by the president.
Another white man, history of violence, custody for shooting and killing two African Americans at a grocery store, Kroger's. But what he tried to do was barge into a predominantly black church. He failed.
It was around 10 Saturday morning. A man walked into Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue and started shooting.
This week was about the reckoning.
Demonstrators believe the president's rhetoric incites acts of violence.
There is a compelling argument for tracing a line between the hateful rhetoric of President Trump and his allies in the right-wing media to attacks on the very groups and individuals they identify as threats to our society. The Clintons, the Obamas, the blacks, the immigrants, the Jews.
The State Department and USAID is partnering with Soros and basically allowing Soros to set our foreign policy agenda.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists.
And they're coming in with diseases such as smallpox and leprosy and TB that are going to infect our people in the United States.
But that line of responsibility for violence is not a clear and continuous one. At most, it is a dotted one. The ugly speech, after all, describes enemies, but for the most part, it doesn't solicit violence. And the lone wolf perpetrators were, by all accounts, kooks.
A picture is emerging now of Sayoc, a troubled, isolated man who was sometimes menacing towards women especially.
Bowers filed a plea of not guilty during his arraignment in federal court this afternoon. And when he walked into the courtroom, he had no emotion, appeared almost confident, even cocky.
Then there is the law, a large body of which, including the First Amendment, protects all manner of political speech. Most recently, a federal appeals court upheld a Kentucky lower court ruling absolving candidate Trump of legal responsibility for protesters being roughed up at one of his campaign rallies after he had directed his supporters to...
Get him out of here! Go out! Get out!
Garrett Epps teaches law at the University of Baltimore. The lower court, he says, found that the events simply didn't match the Kentucky statute governing incitement because Trump didn't specifically tell anyone to harm the protesters. And then the appeals court had further thoughts.
But then they went even further to say, and anyway, the First Amendment protects everything that Trump did.
And what would the candidate have had to say to the crowd for this dotted line of a remark followed by manhandling to be deemed an actual incitement?
If a candidate or a speaker at an event like that pointed at a specific person and said, get him, or knock the blank out of him, and the person was then assaulted, then we're in the realm of incitement within the meaning of the First Amendment.
The standard of direct, explicit, plausible incitement has deep roots in U.S. law and was crystallized in the 1969 case called Brandenburg versus Ohio about a hapless Ku Klux Klan demonstration.
They burned a cross, and then Mr. Brandenburg made a somewhat incoherent speech about their opposition to black people and their opposition to Jews and so forth. And then he made these famous remarks that every First Amendment lawyer knows basically by heart. He said, we, meaning the Klan, we are not a revengeant organization, but if our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, there might have to be some revengeance taken. So he seemed to be threatening revengeance, bearing in mind that this was on private land. There was no crowd. There was no imminent violence because he was addressing a bunch of guys in sheets and a TV crew, none of whom was about to go do anything, and there was nobody nearby for him to do anything to.
Brandenburg was arrested under an Ohio law against advocating for the overthrow of the government. The case eventually reached the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled not so fast.
If you're going to be arresting people and charging them with inciting violence through their words, then you're going to have to prove some pretty important elements. You're going to have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person intended to and was likely to cause imminent violent action.
It's not that the court was losing sleep over the fate of robed bigots, but it was concerned about the wholesale arrests in the South of civil rights protesters whom it deemed vulnerable to similar charges. Speech, even raucous speech, even militant speech, had to be protected. It's foundational to American democracy. But here's the thing. The First Amendment was designed to protect individual citizens in their dissent against government, not to empower the government to smear its citizens. And never mind hate speech. Up until now, U.S. presidents have avoided provocative statements on any subject. Presidential historian Michael Beschloss is the author, most recently, of Presidents at War.
Almost every president in history has known that one liberty he gives up is the liberty to say exactly what he thinks about everything under the sun. And one of the things that you often hear presidents saying after they leave the presidency is how liberated they feel. George H.W. Bush used to say, you know, I'm free at last. Finally, I can say what I think. That's not a luxury that a sitting president gets.
An incautious utterance, after all, can trigger a stock market panic, a diplomatic crisis, civil unrest. In 1990, President George H.W. Bush triggered a protest caravan of angry agribusinessmen to Washington for saying this.
I do not like broccoli, and I haven't liked it since I was a little kid, and my mother made me eat it, and I'm president of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli.
The broccoli industrial complex is one thing. The stakes get a little higher. In 1984, Ronald Reagan made a joke on the campaign trail that he thought was off mic.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
People thought that that was a signal of what was really on Reagan's mind, and it was certainly used against Reagan politically.
So what to make of the discarded norm of presidential sobriety? Is that a new factor to weigh in the definition of incitement? And what about this factor? That line of responsibility that to observers is so inconclusively dotted may to the culprit be as solid as a direct command.
They are always egged on. I mean, terrorism never happens in a silo or a vacuum, ever.
Amanda Robb is a journalist specializing in the acts of domestic terrorists, a grim fascination that began with the murder of her uncle, a Buffalo, New York gynecologist who performed abortions. So-called pro-life activists had published leaflets with his face in the crosshairs of a rifle, moving him to write a 1994 letter to his local paper, the Buffalo News.
And in it, he said, you know, don't be surprised when one of the more fragile-minded members of your community, when one of your followers shoots an abortion provider. And 20 years ago last week, he was shot and killed in his own kitchen in front of his wife and children. I wrote a story a couple of years back about Robert Deere, who was the man who shot 12 people at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And he was heavily influenced by doctored videos allegedly showing abortion providers selling baby body parts. That was the language that was being used, and that was the language that was used in Congress. Marsha Blackburn, who's now running for Senate in Tennessee, started a whole subcommittee to investigate the selling of baby body parts. And that's what incited him. That's why he chose that spot.
Rob spoke to these men. She heard their righteous rationalizations tying directly back to what they had heard and read. Another was Edgar Madison Welsh, the North Carolina man who was moved by the Pizzagate ravings of Alex Jones to take weapons into a Washington, D.C. pizzeria to liberate children from what he believed was a child sex slave ring operated by Hillary Clinton and fellow Democrats. Shots were fired.
It was definitely, to him, like, straight from Alex Jones, and it was more credible because General Flynn was retweeting it, and, I mean, he totally says that's where he got it, and he will tell you that.
As someone who's experienced this journalistically and personally, is there an overriding moral principle that says that we can connect the dots in that dotted line and assign blame to those who spew the hatred?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people don't randomly choose enemies. They have to be pointed towards hate. And people are being very pointed.
American law, as we have seen, is not only ill-equipped to evaluate cause and effect, but engineered to err on the side of more speech, not less. The same cannot be said for elsewhere in the world. In Europe, where hateful scapegoating from politicians and right-wing media delivered an unthinkable holocaust, there are strict laws against incitement and hate speech. As Professor Epps observes,
candidate Trump, if he were for some reason to run for president of France, would find himself in some serious criminal jeopardy, perhaps in Germany too.
Criminal jeopardy. Till now, in our inquiry on culpability, we've weighed the sanctity of the First Amendment against the toll of impunity, compared the criminal laws of the United States and Europe, and contrasted the standards of the law against the admitted intentions of the criminals. But for most of history, and still today, secular law has had a parallel in moral law, mainly in the form of religious doctrine, such as the Ten Commandments, the ninth of which declares, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." Don't lie, and especially don't make false accusations. Here is conservative radio host Dennis Prager.
The Hebrew Bible was so adamant on this subject that the punishment imposed on a witness who gave false testimony was the same as the punishment that would have been meted out to the accused had the false testimony been believed.
Not to suggest that matters of culpability can or should be litigated by the clergy, just to say that in the drawing of lines, the world offers no consensus, yet plenty of certainty on how to connect the dots. Coming up, anti-Semitism. As Chris Rock says, that train's never late. This is On the Media.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Yes, drawing a straight line between the massacre of 11 Jewish men and women at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last weekend and the anti-Semitic rhetoric in the Trump administration and the pro-Trump media is a fraught affair. Because, after all, blaming Trump for Jew hatred is like blaming him for cancer.
We need to get something off the table right away.
Jewish conservative pundit Ben Shapiro.
When an anti-Semitic attack occurs, you generally don't need to bother blaming particular politicians. Anti-Semitism is literally as old as the Jewish people. Literally as old as the Jewish people.
Shapiro is wrong on the contemporaneous facts. The alleged Pittsburgh shooter directly tied his act to supposed Jewish culpability for the Central American caravan, characterized by Trump and his allies as diseased and criminal invaders. But according to Leo Ferguson of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, it's also historically untrue. Ferguson's work focuses on debunking many of the myths and the myths about Jews.
part of what you're seeing is two different ideas. One that sort of comes from within certain corners of Judaism, especially on the right, and one that comes from without. And the one that Ben Shapiro is referring to is the idea that anti-Semitism is almost a force of nature, a natural law, something that is inevitable and immutable. And, of course, on the other side, you have the sort of erasure of anti-Semitism at all from the acts of violence we've seen. So you have, you know, Kellyanne Conway.
The anti-religiosity in this country, that it's so, somehow in vogue and funny to make fun of anybody of faith, to constantly be making fun of people who express religion.
And, of course, Trump not mentioning Jews when talking about the Holocaust last year. They're both serving the same purpose, which is to sort of create a vague confusion about the origins of anti-Semitism and, of course, the purposes of anti-Semitism.
Now, make no mistake, there is a long history to anti-Semitism, and it's horrific, but it didn't begin at the beginning.
So anti-Semitism comes specifically out of Christianity. It comes out of Europe and capitalism or proto-capitalism. You had Jews who are a diasporic people who are migrating throughout Europe and in a set of forces that should be very familiar to anyone watching the very ugly immigration politics of the Trump administration today. You have the idea that folks are competing economically with the Christians who are already there. And so rulers had a huge incentive to bar Jews from owning land and from becoming merchants and tradesmen. And so Jews were forced to find other ways to put food on the table. And you saw them essentially taking jobs that Christians didn't want. There were all these Christian Catholic prohibitions on handling money, on money lending. And so it was very, very convenient for Jews to be funneled into those roles. And that's where the basic set of ideas about Jews and money comes from. Of course, the dark side of this was that when things went bad economically or when rulers raised taxes or otherwise oppressed their populations, Jews became the targets. They became the scapegoats. And this is the role that Jews have played historically for centuries.
And on top of that, they were putatively Christ killers. So that would make them even greater scapegoats when the economy turns sour.
Yeah, that's correct. One of the complexities of anti-Semitism is that it takes a bunch of different forms. And so sometimes it can be essentially economic, it can be xenophobic, it can also be religious. And then, of course, later on, you get racialization. And so then you get the ideas that Jews are a mongrel, lesser race. You see that in Nazi ideology.
One recurring theme continues to be the notion that Jews control the world's economy, that they are natively genius in all matters of money. I'm going to play a little tape from South Park.
Dude, we don't have time for your stupid jokes. We're going to die.
Yes, but you can live if you give me your Jew gold. The decision is yours, Cab.
You know I don't carry gold in a little bag around my neck, Carmen. What do you want from me?
I want your Jew gold.
Okay, fine. Here.
Do you think I'm stupid? I know that all Jews carry fake bags of gold around their necks to keep the real bags of gold around their necks safe. Hand over the real Jew gold, Cab.
Now, that's kind of postmodern. That's ironic. Ridiculing, unfortunately, a very real and deadly trope.
Yeah, and that trope was on full display with the shootings in Pittsburgh and, of course, the bomb scare that we just had. These conspiracy theories go all the way back again to medieval Europe. They go back to the idea of the blood libel, which is sort of the original Jewish conspiracy theory, this fakey-fake idea that Jews drink the blood of Christians. Fast forward to the 19th century, and you have the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is sort of the modern reincarnation of this old idea. You have a revolutionary movement in Russia in which folks are teaming up to overthrow the Tsar, sort of an oppressive monarch. And Jews are very much a part of that movement, as Jews have often been, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries. Jews have been at the center of movements for social justice in Europe and in the United States. So you have a lot of Jewish leaders in that movement. And so the Russian secret police, with the help of a pro-Tsar propagandist, cook up and then disseminate the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is another fakey-fake document purporting to be the minutes of a secret Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. And this successfully turns people against Jews. It divides the movement and ultimately crushes the movement.
the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you know, you'd like to think, well, it's a quaint 19th century smear that was fully debunked and completely eradicated from history.
You can buy a copy from street vendors on the streets of New York. I mean, it's everywhere. It's been translated into many languages. Henry Ford famously disseminated it widely in the United States. He was a pretty virulent anti-Semite.
George Soros is the ultimate villain of the global Jewish conspiracy to pull the strings of our society. Trump used his image in his final campaign ad before the 2016 election as an example of globalists interfering in our affairs.
For those who control the levers of power in Washington and for the global special interests, they partner with these people that don't have your good in mind.
And only last week, Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch was a guest on Lou Dobbs' show on Fox, claiming that George Soros was working with our own government to bring the Honduran caravan to the border.
A lot of these folks also have affiliates who are getting money from the Soros-occupied State Department.
George Soros is foreign. He has an accent. He wasn't well known, and so he's a little bit of a blank slate on which people can project their fears and, of course, conspiracy theories. And it couldn't simply be that George Soros is doing something that philanthropists around the world do every day, and that certainly many Christians have done. They give money to causes that they care about. He's doing something very mundane. But when you add in this anti-Semitic element, you get the sense that there is something inherently illegitimate and un-American about his activities. You know, Steven Spielberg is a household name and he's a well-known quantity. And so even though he is a Jew and a Democrat who gives lots of money to lefty causes, it's hard to portray him as a bizarre, strange outsider with nefarious motives. But who's George Soros? He's just a name.
I want to play you a piece of tape that came from Ben Shapiro once again, saying, never mind Donald Trump, what about these others?
Who do you think has made the world less safe for Jews? President Trump and his winking and nodding at the alt-right? Or the left, which mainstreams Louis Farrakhan, which mainstreams Linda Sarsour, which mainstreams the BDS movement, which mainstreams wildly anti-Israel and anti-Semitic policies. Which one do you think is more damaging to Jews all across the world and in the United States?
It has never been more clear that BDS activists are not what the American Jewish community has to be afraid of. Louis Farrakhan, who is a virulent anti-Semite, has, you know, no real political power. It has never been more obvious than it is this week that the people who have inflicted the most violence and damage on the American Jewish community and on many other communities for hundreds and, in fact, you know, at this point, you know, a couple thousand years are white Christians, primarily men, especially on the right.
Is it my imagination or is there a bit of reticence on the left to even discussing anti-Semitism? It seems to me that it's somehow deemed awkward.
For decades, virtually the only people talking about anti-Semitism were folks on the right. It was used specifically to defend and support Israel, and it was also used to silence criticism of Israel. So you saw a lot of false or inflated charges of anti-Semitism to shut down Students for Justice in Palestine or Jewish Voice for Peace or other organizations working in solidarity with Palestinians or to hold Israel accountable. So the sense that both it was associated with the right and that charges of anti-Semitism were somehow, you know, almost always illegitimate or suspect, I think made many folks on the left really reticent to engage. There was a hesitancy and a suspicion about whether anti-Semitism was real, whether it was significant, or whether it was basically just right-wing propaganda.
There's one thing about anti-Semitism that seems to me different from other forms of oppression. Oppression, by its nature, tends to be the powerful versus the powerless, whether we're talking about African Americans or undocumented workers crossing the border for economic opportunity. Jews, on the other hand, have prospered more or less in most of the societies where the diaspora has taken them.
The role that anti-Semitism has played in capitalism has been to create a pressure release valve for people's sense of injustice around capitalism. If you have an economic system that basically requires inequity to function, you need a story for why it's not working well, or else people might get the idea that they might want to change the system. So in order for that story to be plausible, you have to have a plausible villain. Most Jews, through most of history, have been poor and oppressed. But at various times, and in a number of these places in which we've lived, you also have Jews who become more assimilated into society, who have more access to wealth and success. And when that begins to happen, it suddenly makes the story that Jews are, in fact, secretly very powerful more plausible.
80 years ago, in the German media, conversations exactly like this were taking place. And then you know what happened. Is there anything that gives you hope that that nightmarish trajectory is not in store for us?
Oh, I am filled with hope. I'm hopeful because of the outpourings of support and solidarity I've seen from other non-Jewish communities, you know, flooding my inbox and my voicemail and my text messages. This may be new for white Ashkenazi Jews in the U.S. It is not new for many, many people of color and many other communities that have been facing this kind of oppression for decades and centuries. We have lessons to teach each other and stories to tell each other about how to survive and resist and thrive, even when times are scary and dangerous. There is a way forward, and the way forward is solidarity and friendship and figuring out the ways in which our interests are actually deeply aligned with one another.
Leo, thank you.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Leo Ferguson is an organizer for Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. If solidarity and the recognition of mutual self-interest are the keys to moving past our fractious moment, it can be hard to see how we'll get there. Anger and tribalism appear to be at an all-time high, creating political and societal rifts that seem unbridgeable. Indeed, it is hard to believe that only 70 years ago, the country was deemed by political scientists to be not polarized enough, leading, it was said, to confusion and disengagement on the part of the electorate.
So in 1950, the American Political Science Association put out a report that suggested that, in fact, the parties were not distinct enough and that it was making people's political decision-making too difficult.
Over the next few decades, they became distinct, all right. Liliana Mason is a political psychologist at the University of Maryland. She says most people know exactly what each party stands for, leaving us with two camps that both seek to destroy the other. To understand that enmity, we need to look no further than the Robbers Cave experiment.
In 1954, some psychologists collected a bunch of fifth grade boys from the Oklahoma City area, and they divided them into two camps, and they kept the boys completely separate for the first week of camp. And the boys came up with their own names for what their camps were called. One was the Rattlers and one was the Eagles. And in the second week, they let them know that there was another camp down the road. And immediately the boys wanted to have a competition. And the more the boys competed, the more they began to hate each other. They called each other nasty names. And then things began to fall apart. They began throwing rocks at one another. And at one point, it got so violent that the experimenters had to separate them because they were so worried about the boys' safety. So really, all that it took was separating them into two different groups, allowing them to form an identity, and then letting them sort of have at each other. And we all like to think that we're more mature than fifth grade boys, and hopefully we are. But in general, that motive is a very deep-seated psychological motive. Once we are in a group, we think our group is the best, and we think that the other groups are less good. And if we're in competition with those groups, we begin to hate them.
What's interesting to me is that these groups that were placed in opposition to one another was random. When we're speaking of tribalism, what is the role of deliberation and judgment and agency? How much of this is free will and how much of it is just who we happen to be born as?
That's a very deep question. Part of it comes with the way that we were raised. And even partisanship is something that some of the earlier scholars of political behavior said, you know, that partisanship is something that's learned at your mother's knee. If you live in a political household, you grow up learning that you're a partisan. in a similar way that you grow up learning that you are, you know, a Christian if you go to church. And some identities are unavoidable, like race. Some identities are things that we choose. But the most important thing to know about identity is that whether it's something that is given to you or you choose, the most powerful identities are the ones whose status is being threatened. It's the threat to the status, not just whether the status is high or low. And it's very easy to make people think about one identity or another simply by telling them that someone has insulted their group or that their group is about to lose in some type of competition. When we see politicians talking about identities or groups, one thing that they have a lot of power in is helping us think about which groups are most important to us by telling us which groups are the most threatened.
All right, I understand this notion of winning and losing and feeling that your side is under threat. But back in the supposedly hypo-partisan 50s, many voters actually toggled between parties based on the economy or wars or other transitory circumstances. What do voting records show about today? Is it about issues or is it just threats to the tribe?
There was a Pew study. People were asked whether they approved background checks for gun purchases at a federal level. 86% of Republicans agreed that this would be a good policy to have in place. And then they were asked whether they believed that the government should pass a bill enacting background checks at a federal level. And once it was phrased that way, only 50-something percent of Republicans agreed that a bill should be passed. These people who believed that the legislation would be good for the country as a whole also believed that it would be bad for their party. And in those scenarios, there are a substantial number of people who will choose the party's victory over what they think is best for the nation as a whole. The fact that a party could switch positions and maintain its voting base almost completely, that's actually a very concerning development because it removes accountability. In the 1950s, when people would switch between parties if the party did something that upset them, that was a mechanism by which voters held elected officials accountable. And without that ability, it's a lot harder for voters to hold not only elected officials accountable, but also to even pay attention to what their elected officials are doing, because the most important thing in their mind is whether or not the party is winning.
We're talking about winning and losing. We're talking about this political moment where it is all important for the rattlers to defeat the eagles, even if they have to resort to violence. Is it any wonder that lunatic partisans are trying to kill perceived enemies? And is there any reason to think that the events of last week were an outlier versus the leading edge of some sort of Sarajevo, Rwanda future where blood is spilled for the team?
Right. So that is the worst possible scenario, that all of this partisan dehumanization and social distancing and need for victory becomes something that encourages widespread violence. I think a couple of other things are worrisome in that regard, right? One is the potential for the loss of the legitimacy of our electoral outcomes. If people don't trust the outcome of elections, then the basic machinery of democracy ceases to function. These are kind of the weakest spots of our democracy, and they are being tested. We have seen violence and assassinations in American history. The 1960s were not a peaceful time. And so this is not a completely new thing. The difference is that today, those types of conflicts that we saw in the 1960s are mapped onto our partisanship. Our elections determine how angry or happy we are with what's happening politically. And so elections can possibly become flashpoints for this type of violence.
Perhaps especially when the electorate has been groomed to believe that the system is rigged and that there is a deep state trying to delegitimize the elected administration and et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. And when one side is particularly encouraging of this, it ends up being an asymmetric effect where the vast majority of Americans don't believe that violence is acceptable at all. particularly in advancing political goals. But some partisans do. And there are enough partisans that accept political violence that it could become dangerous. Now, we can look to other countries. This is not my area of specialty, but there are other political scientists who study the emergence of civil war in other countries. And there's a political scientist named Joel Selway who does interesting work in this. And he says there are three major predictors of civil war. One is ethnic or religious fractionalization along political lines, which we have. Two is adverse regime change, which would be something like a contested election or an election outcome that many people feel is illegitimate.
Or an impeachment.
Right. Some sort of regime change that seems illegitimate. But the third is economic catastrophe. That's the one thing that I think is really keeping Americans sort of settled down, is that the economy right now is relatively healthy and comfortable people don't commit violence in general. In a comfortable society, it really does take a relatively unhinged type of person to commit these types of acts. And so to the extent that it is limited right now to effectively domestic terrorism, we're not in Rwanda.
No, but we may be in Yugoslavia.
We're hoping that that's not the case. It's a very frightening prospect. And in terms of my research, the best way to get out of it is for there to be some sort of new realignment of the parties. What started this was a massive rift in the Democratic Party after the Civil Rights Act. If there's a massive rift in either party again, particularly the Republican Party, we could see a new set of cues that the parties are giving us and new political information that's giving us some mixed messages, or we have cross-cutting identities that emerge. And if there were to be a rift in one party, it would reduce polarization because people would have a less clear sense of us and them.
Liliana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liliana Mason is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and author of Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. Coming up, Sunshine Pilates and Evidently Evil, the California Threat. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. All this hour, we've been hearing about demonization, the rift between us, whoever we are, and them, the outgroup, the other. But in midterm contests across the country this year, one of the most sinister and invasive others isn't an outgroup, it's an outplace. California.
Make no mistake about it. If I don't win this race, we will be turning into what? California, okay?
She's backed by billionaires and socialists who want to make Georgia into California.
And just the other day, he was asked about his economic vision, and he said that he thought the government policy in California was the model.
From Nevada to Georgia to Florida and states in between, the disloyal opposition is California, and one Californian in particular. You might be familiar with her. She favors pearls.
Hollywood celebrities who are blinded by their hatred of the president. Nancy Pelosi and the Washington Democrats answer to them. There's no new agenda. Behind the poll-tested slogan are the same old liberal ideas. Single-payer healthcare, sanctuary cities, job-crushing taxes, and big cuts to our military. Pelosi's San Francisco values are wrong for America.
Not a brand new nemesis, of course. Pelosi became a prominent target during the 2006 midterms, when Republicans warned that if she became Speaker of the House, the sweet promise of America would turn sour dough.
Now, I mean, Nancy Pelosi represents a San Francisco value system.
Fast forward 12 years, and it's less a coded warning about gay rights and permissive social policies, and more about Trump and how the state is challenging the president on everything from car emission standards to immigration policy to legalizing weed.
Not my president! Not my president!
The California Republic versus President Trump.
The resistance is legion.
Some of that resistance is manifesting in out-of-state donations to key races that are deemed Trump referendums. Take, for instance, the Senate contest in Texas, where Ted Cruz is facing a challenge from Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who is breaking fundraising records.
We are seeing tens of millions of dollars flooding into the state of Texas from liberals all over the country who desperately want to turn the state of Texas blue. They want us to be just like California. Right down to tofu and silicon and dyed hair.
Well, two things. It's true that O'Rourke has gotten a lot of cash from out of state, but so has Cruz. Who's gotten more is actually up for debate, though a Dallas Morning News analysis of itemized donations shows that it's Cruz. The other thing? Silicone and dyed hair? Has Cruz never been to Dallas?
Well, Ted's from Canada. You have to keep that in mind. So he's still adjusting to the entire United States, I believe.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. He says the anti-California talking point may even have originated in Texas.
As a way to defend against the assault on government. And, you know, in order to keep taxes low at the expense of government services, you have to create a kind of a boogeyman. And the boogeyman is California.
The truth is, Texas is being Californiaized.
Perhaps no Texan talks about California more than Governor Greg Abbott.
It's being done at the city level with bag bans, fracking bans, tree cutting bans. We're forming a patchwork quilt of bans and rules and regulations that is eroding the Texas model.
You know, when I was young, Texas was blue and California was red. Texas, you know, produced Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, and California produced Ronald Reagan and the modern conservative revolution.
Actually, I think you could spend a lifetime just seeing and getting to know California. Someone has said California isn't a place, it's a way of life. Well, that's true, and it's a good way.
These states are mirror images in some ways, kind of like strands of DNA, like a double helix. You know, they revolve around each other. They never coincide, but they're always in a relationship. And it says a lot about the dynamism of our country, the laboratories of democracy the states are supposed to be. I remember Rick Perry, our former governor, used to call it lavatories of democracy. I think he might. I don't know if he meant that or not.
You left out that they're like the number one and number two largest states in population. And yet, California elects virtually no Republicans statewide, and Texas elects virtually no Democrats. If there are so many similarities, why are they mirror images and not exact political duplicates?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think they've always been in opposition to each other, and they reflect the kind of political opposition that often characterizes our country. When I was young, we looked at California as a kind of hotbed of right-wing fanaticism. Of course, I lived in Dallas, which was a hotbed of right-wing fanaticism, but it felt akin to what was going on in California. You know,
it was the home of the John Birch Society.
Yeah, there was a lot of things that we had in common, but I don't know, we always seemed to run to the corners.
Wright and Governor Abbott don't agree on much, but both believe the struggle between California and Texas is the struggle over the soul of America.
There is a growing divide in this country that is epitomized by the difference between California and Texas. There is a divide between capitalism on the one hand and socialism on the other hand.
California as a socialist paradise. That's also a refrain deep in the heart of Florida.
They have massive taxes on all levels.
Republican gubernatorial candidate Ron DeSantis.
Stiff state income tax for middle-income people. And in fact, they've really hollowed out the middle class in California because of all the burdens imposed on government.
In other words, a failed socialist nightmare where government regulation is onerous and taxpayer money is squandered. Is the state paying people to surf?
Unfortunately, we have not moved into a place where anybody's being paid to surf unless they're professional surfers.
Marisa Lagos is co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast and a political reporter at San Francisco's KQED.
No, this is not a socialist state. It certainly, I think, is more progressive and generous when it comes to a lot of, you know, the public welfare programs that maybe states like Florida have not embraced, but I wouldn't call it a socialist state.
Furthermore, as failed states go, it's doing pretty well. California has a $9 billion budget surplus this year, a big turnaround from the $27 billion deficit when Democrat Jerry Brown took over from Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2011. But if not a socialist nightmare, not necessarily a paradise either.
I think that there is, in some ways, you know, sort of a tale of two Californias here, to borrow some politicians' lines. Housing is a big problem here, and I think that that is something that we're seeing a lot of people grapple with when it comes time for them to maybe want to put down roots and raise a family. Is that even possible in a region like the Bay Area?
California's homeless population jumped by 14% between 2016 and 2017, and yes, taxes are high. And so some Californians have taken to moving out, many in search of cheaper real estate, 1 million of them in a 9-year stretch. Not in caravans, but maybe Priuses.
I would say the traffic is the biggest thing.
And many feel they're bringing bad driving habits.
They still drive like they're in California.
In 2015, 25% of newcomers to Idaho, one of the fastest growing states in the country, were from California. And they weren't all pot-smoking LGBT pro-choicers. This from Fox News Channel.
There's one Republican who said he is done with California and decided to move to Texas. Once he figured out a lot of people did the same thing, he started a company called Conservative Move to help his fellow conservatives move to more like-minded states.
Great schools, great jobs, low crime. Those things don't exist in the liberal bastions of California where we escaped from.
So far, you've just talked about California. Are you encouraging people to move from, like, New York, for example, or New Jersey, or Connecticut, or Massachusetts, for heaven's sake?
Still, truth be told, the electoral edge created by expats does fall to the Democrats, at least in Colorado, where California is a hot-button issue in the governor's race.
Radical. Now add this.
Radicalifornia?
That's what you get when you bring radical left-wing policies to your state.
Oh. Policies that already failed.
2004 was actually the last year that Colorado voted for a Republican in the presidential race. Democrats have held at least one chamber of the state house for a while now, and there's a decent chance they'll have unified control of the state government here after next week's elections.
Seth Maskett is a professor of political science at the University of Denver and the director of the Center on American Politics there. The California migration, he says, is one of the reasons Colorado is trending from purple to blue. And he should know, because if Californiaism is a disease, he is a pathogen, from Berkeley, no less.
When I first moved here, for example, it was almost impossible to buy alcohol on a Sunday. And there's been changes in the law surrounding that. It's now obviously legal to purchase recreational marijuana here. Colorado is actually ahead of California on that curve. The style of life has been pretty dramatically transformed just in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you actually came from California in order to destroy the fabric of Coloradan culture, or if that was just collateral damage.
I assure you that was not my intention. It was purely for economic reasons.
But look here. Many of the tens of thousands of Angelenos and Bay Areans who fled to enjoy lower housing costs have themselves driven the price of Denver real estate through the roof. If you're a Coloradan who can't afford to buy a home or stay in your rental, how not to blame Californication? And how can politicians not seize on the resentment about the George Soros of states?
It's become just kind of a classic boogeyman that it almost doesn't need to even mean anything anymore. People just use the words and it means whatever horrible thing you want it to mean.
You know, I'm in a band, and the drummer in our band on his drum kit has a sticker that says, "Don't Californicate Texas music." I have no idea what that means.
Journalist Lawrence Wright.
So it's a buzzword. It's a trope for, you know, the outsider, the other. And it's also one of those chest-thumping Texas-isms
I must ask you this. You live in Austin and you're in a band. Is band membership mandatory there?
It's not. It's kind of like the military. It's a volunteer organization. You don't have to serve, but you'd be wise to do so. You know, the music in Austin is really such a deep part of the city, and I'm so grateful that I got to be a part of that.
And if you lived in L.A., you know what you'd be a part of? Pilates.
Don't look down at it. I do Pilates as well. I guess that's part of our L.A. experience here in Austin.
Ugh. See? It's everywhere. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chattavredi. We had more help from Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.